From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week we remember the late composer Ennio Morricone as we listen to his classic theme, From the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Morricone died last Monday at the age of 91. In this week's movies, our critics review Tom Hanks starring in Greyhound. He also wrote the screenplay of the film. The romantic comedy Palm Springs pairs Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti, and we'll hear about the German drama A Regular Woman. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We get started right after NPR News.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. You're listening to music from Ennio Morricone's score from Brian De Palma's film The Untouchables from 1987. Morricone received an Oscar nomination for Best Original Score, one of many nominations that he received. Oscar winner, of course, Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy. Morricone, who died last weekend with a tremendous body of film work. We'll talk about that a little bit later on Film Week. First, let me introduce our critics this week. They are Peter Rayner, film critic for the Christian Science Monitor, Claudia Puig, president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com. Our first movie this week stars Tom Hanks, Stephen Graham, and Rob Morgan. It's directed by Aaron Schneider. It's Greyhound, and it's streaming on Apple TV+. Wade, what did you think of Greyhound?
It is a wonderful, old-fashioned, heroic World War II film, the kind of stuff that you would have seen sometime between about the end of the war and the mid-1960s before we got cynical again. Tom Hanks really has a feel for this period. He wrote a terrific script. It's not a complicated movie. It doesn't reinvent the genre. It's basically about a sea captain escorting a convoy across the Atlantic through the most dangerous part of the Atlantic where there are U-boats stalking them and trying to get this convoy to Europe to supply the war. And this is the first time that he's actually commanded a ship in this circumstance. And it's really a cat and mouse movie for the most part. It's U-boats and a convoy, and there's a lot of very technical dialogue that clearly Tom Hanks researched to within an inch of his life. But it works, and it works beautifully, and some superb special effects. I just found it a really wonderful, rousing, old-fashioned World War II film.
The movie is Greyhound. Claudia?
Well, it is indeed old-fashioned and heroic, but I think I'm a little bit less high on it than Wade. Tom Hanks is great in the heroic everyman lead character. He's in full command of this victory at sea adventure thriller. But I really wanted to, this is something I really wish I'd seen on a big screen. I think these kind of epic war films are best seen on a big screen. I remember seeing Letters from Iwo Jima on my TV and then seeing it on a big screen. I had an entirely different feeling for it. And Sony had originally, of course, planned to release it in theaters and of course sold it to Apple Plus. But the other problem I have with it, I know it was adapted from a C.S. Forster novel, but the problem I have with it is, it's taut, it's brisk, and it's focused, but I didn't know enough about the characters. I didn't learn enough about the characters. It's very suspenseful. The action sequences are great. I would have liked to have known a little bit more about the characters' backstories and had some more character development.
Tom Hanks wrote the screenplay. What did you think of the dialogue he wrote, Claudia?
I thought the dialogue was great. It was lean. It was economical. It was, it felt very authentic in terms of the jargon. So I had no problem with the writing whatsoever. I just wanted to know more about the characters. And maybe that's a testimony to the fact that this was a good story. But I would have liked a little bit more. Rob Morgan has a key part. And I wish there had been more to his part. I think I would have felt more emotionally invested.
Yeah. Wade, do you agree with any of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not trying that. Like I said, it doesn't really reinvent the genre. It doesn't push it to new heights, which, it's not Bridge on the River Kwai. It's not even Das Boot. It's kind of Das Boot from the other side a little bit. But really, it's sort of like the big World War II naval version of The End of the Road Warrior, which is effectively just a cat and mouse scenario. So I think it succeeds in what it's trying to do, and I think it succeeds very, very well. And again, the dialogue is so authentic and so rich. You feel the ship operations as authentic as if you were there.
All right, the film is Greyhound. It's rated PG-13, streaming on Apple TV+. Tom Hanks stars, wrote the screenplay, Aaron Schneider, the director. The romantic comedy Palm Springs stars Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. The film's directed by Max Barbacow, and Andy Ciara is the screenwriter. Claudia, what'd you think of Palm Springs?
I liked it a lot, and I went in with sort of middling expectations, but it really succeeds at what it's trying to do. It's kind of an inventive new take on Groundhog's Day. It has these very likable lead performances by Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. It has more on its mind than kind of the run-of-the-mill rom-com. It probes whether love can be lasting. It has deeper psychology about what it means to be happy. So there's something more provocative to it than just kind of a wacky rom-com. But it also is fun and buoyant and funny. There's a little bit of melancholy to it. I think it's sort of more contemplative in some ways. And it works really well with the construct of this time loop, and they have terrific chemistry. I think the film really belongs to Milioti, which is nice. I feel like Samberg kind of stands back and lets her take the spotlight. She has great comic range. She can do, offbeat as well as the darker dramatic beats. She's a very believable actress. And, the whole time loop thing is kind of a genre of its own with Groundhog Day, obviously.
That's what I always think of, yeah.
Yeah. And then Russian Doll on TV, which is really great with Natasha Lyonne, Edge of Tomorrow. So, yeah, it's a subgenre, and I feel like this is a really good effort. Oh, and it's got a really great supporting cast with J.K. Simmons and Peter Gallagher, Dale Dickey. So, yeah, I think it works perfectly.
Palm Springs, a romantic comedy. Wade.
I agree with everything Claudia said. I concur 100%. And A Star is Born. Milioti is amazing in this. It's true. Samberg sits back and lets her own the movie. And it's to his credit. He recognizes that he has a job to do, and at a certain point he has to kind of hand it off to her because she is the heart and soul of the film. She runs the gamut of emotions. She pulls at your heartstrings. She makes you laugh. She just owns this movie in a wonderful way. And, it's amazing they don't do this more often. And this happens in classical music all the time, where they will look at a musical theme and other composers will do variations on it. I don't know why something as great as Groundhog Day hasn't inspired more filmmakers to take that idea, which is so rich to be mined for so many other things. The Groundhog Day didn't fully explore that idea. It did it to a certain extent. And this takes it to a whole new level. And I give the filmmakers and the screenwriters all the credit in the world. They did a wonderful job of taking a great movie and running an extra mile with it.
The director is Max Barbacow. Andy Ciara is the screenwriter. Andy Samberg, Kristen Milioti, star in Palm Springs. Rated R. It's streaming on Hulu, but you can see it at the drive-in at the Van Buren in Riverside and the Mission Tiki in Montclair. Palm Springs is rated R. The German film A Regular Woman tells the story of a Turkish woman escaping her violent marriage and the repercussions within her family. The film is directed by Sherry Horman. Peter, what'd you think of A Regular Woman?
This is a really terrific movie. It's one of the very best movies of the year. It's based on a real-life honor killing that received quite a bit of publicity in 2005, a 23-year-old woman who grew up in a strict Sunni Muslim family in Germany with, you know, the Turkish family originally, and she was killed by her youngest brother. She was one of nine siblings. That's known right from the get-go, so I'm not giving anything away. In 1998, she was 16, and she was sent to, back to Istanbul to marry a cousin, and that didn't take. So she came back to her family in Germany, and they sort of reluctantly brought her back in, but it became too crowded and dysfunctional, so she moved out and adopted Western ways. She dropped the burqa. She, you know, went dancing. She had a German boyfriend, but she was virulently harassed by her brothers throughout all of this, made her life really miserable, and ultimately ended the way it did. The character of the Anyur is her name, played by a marvelous actress, Almila Bagriacik, narrates the film in a post-mortem narration, so it gives it a kind of ominous, impending a fatality to the whole tone of the film, but it's so beautifully done and so powerful, and it anatomizes what this woman is going through so amazingly that you know it has a cumulative force, this film, that I think really stays with you. Certainly stayed with me.
We're talking about A Regular Woman, a film from Germany, Claudia.
Yeah, I agree 100% with Peter. This is tragic and illuminating. It's also very intimately told. It's very stylistically intriguing. The post-mortem narration, I think, really works because it kind of presents the story from the victim's perspective. It restores her voice, in a sense, because she's telling the story, you know, from beyond the grave. And her family sought to silence her voice. So it's all the more powerful, I think. And also the narration sort of finds a way to explain honor killings within the context, of course, of the Sunni Muslim fundamentalist perspective that, you know, they come from. It, even though we know what's going to happen, and we learn early on, of course, that she's killed and this is a true story, watching it unfold is still really suspenseful. And then in the very end, they weave in images of the real people subtly, which, you know, adds a lot of power to it. It's really well cast. It's technically really impeccable with sort of the cinematography, the way it's done. It's directed with great assurance. The screenwriter has a background in German TV police procedurals, and that comes through. I think that experience really, you know, stood him in good stead. I really love the way the main character is humanized. Like Peter said, I think the performance, the lead performance by Almila Bagriacik is fantastic. And as are the actors who play her brothers, for whom, you know, religion, family, and honor are everything. And then early on, we also see a montage of Muslim women walking down the street as she's telling the story. They're living ordinary lives in Berlin. And I think that's a really interesting montage, because you realize this could happen to any of them, or could have happened to any of them. So it's a really powerful effect, and it's a really devastating film. It's definitely my favorite of this week, and it's one of my favorite so far of the year.
A Regular Woman is the film. It stars Almila Bagriacik, Sherry Horman, the director, Florian Oler, the screenwriter. It's unrated. You can see A Regular Woman with Lemley's Virtual Cinema to be able to see it through that streaming platform. The Canadian drama Guest of Honor stars David Thewlis. It's written and directed by Adam Ogoyan. Claudia.
I am continually flummoxed by Adam Ogoyan. His movie, The Sweet Hereafter, is one of my favorite films of all time. And so I always look forward to his films, hoping that, you know, it'll come close to that level, which is probably unfair because that film was so impeccable and near perfect that, you know, everything pales in comparison. And I hope I don't judge him on an, you know, excessively high standard. But this is a movie that deals with emotional fallout, and the emotional fallout after a tragedy, kind of in the way that Sweet Hereafter does, but the resemblance kind of ends there. It is beautifully shot by Paul Sorosi, the cinematographer. David Thewlis in the lead performance is pretty great. But the story itself really kind of grows really strained and tangled and frustrating. And melodramatic. It has kind of hypnotic pacing, and I stayed with it. I was never bored, but there's also a little bit of bad acting, which is unfortunately played by the woman who plays Thulis's daughter, Laisla de Oliveira. She just plays it in kind of this inner way. It's a complicated plot. It involves her going to prison for a sex offense that she didn't really commit. And then he's a food inspector. And there's this horrible thing about deep fried rabbit ears, which I hope never to ever see in a movie again or even think about. But anyway, it's a lost opportunity. It feels scattershot and overwrought, unfortunately.
Guest of honor, Canadian film from writer-director Adam Ogoyan. We'll hear what Peter and Wade think about the film as we continue on Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. We also have an Indian drama coming up, Widow of Silence, an action-adventure film starring Charlize Theron, The Old Guard. And we'll talk about the documentary Runner, which has been a real critic's favorite as well. We take you to our break on Film Week with more of the great scores from Ennio Morricone. This from Once Upon a Time in the West. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. You're listening to music from Ennio Morricone, his Academy Award-winning soundtrack for Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. Morricone, who died on Monday at the age of 91, and was extraordinarily prolific, writing the scores to 400-some films in his native Italy, as well as with U.S. filmmakers like Tarantino. We continue on Film Week with our critics, Claudia Puig, Wade Major, and Peter Rayner. We are in the midst of reviewing the film Guest of Honor, starring David Thewlis. It's a Canadian drama that's written and directed by filmmaker Adam Ogoyan. Peter, what did you think of Guest of Honor?
It's kind of a mess, narratively and psychologically. The daughter of the David Thewlis character was in prison for a sexual offense that she did not commit as a school teacher, but confessed to anyway because she wanted to punish herself for another crime. And so there's a sort of who done it or why done it aspect to some of this film, with a lot of time juggling involved that doesn't really gel into much of anything, really, unfortunately. The main reason to see it, I would guess, is David Thewlis's performance. He's quite good. And I don't know of any other movie that featured a food inspector. So on a documentary level, if nothing else, it's sort of interesting to see, how he shows up unannounced into these restaurants and, checks out all the grody stuff.
Maybe Ratatouille. I don't know. Was there a food inspector in that?
Yeah, and I second Claudia's concern about the deep-fried rabbit ears. May they never appear in another movie.
Wade, Guest of Honor.
I
I'm going to be the outlier here. I thoroughly enjoyed the film. I am a longstanding Adam Egoyan fan. I also love The Sweet Hereafter. But Egoyan had a golden period in the 1990s from, you know, when The Adjuster and Exotica and Sweet Hereafter. And, you know, he really nailed like four or five films in a row. And then went awry starting with Ararat, which is unfortunate because that was a lifelong labor of love, and made some real clunkers with Chloe and Where the Truth Lies. And I feel like this, Adoration, is the one in there that kind of was a throwback to what he did well. And I think this is maybe his best film since The Sweet Hereafter. I don't think it compares to The Sweet Hereafter. But the thing that he does so well, which is juggling all of this nonlinear timepieces in this jigsaw puzzle and going backwards and forwards in time and filling in your informational gaps as needed in a very nonlinear fashion. No one else does that as effectively as he does. And I thought it was very engaging and psychologically very interesting.
Guest of honor, Adam Egoyan, writer-director. The movie's unrated. You can see it on the Frida Virtual Cinema and Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Widow of Silence, an Indian drama written and directed by Praveen Morchali. The film stars Shilpi Marva. What do you think, Peter? Widow of Silence.
It's a terrific movie. One has to be prepared for the fact that it is very slow. It sort of takes its time getting to where it's going, and it's very meditative and ruminative and slow. Not at all in the Western tradition that we're used to here, but it's a terrific movie. The background is, the Kashmir Muslim separatists who want to become part of Pakistan, and so there's a, you know, sort of minor warfare going on as part of the plot in the background. But essentially, it's about a woman whose husband was spirited away by security forces 7 years before the film begins, and he's disappeared. She's searched prisons, hospitals, morgues, and he's nowhere to be found. So at a certain point, she wants to get a death certificate so she could move on with various aspects of her life, but getting the death certificate from the official involved is extraordinarily difficult because he's so corrupt and the system is so corrupt that she's caught up in. And how she retaliates against that official is the gist of the movie. The performance by Shilpi Marwaha is first rate. The direction is reminded me a lot of Kiarostami films in the way that the landscape kind of, is a character in the film itself. You know, a beautiful landscape and yet very, ominous and scary because of what's going on within it. It really is, it has much more than ethnographic value, but I think that, the cumulative force of this film is similar in some ways to what I was mentioning earlier with A Regular Woman. I mean, both of these films deal with women who are, caught in a societal bind that's, really lacerating. And the way it's worked out in this film, I think, is quite powerful.
The Indian drama Widow of Silence, Claudia.
I agree. And sort of interesting to see on the same week with A Regular Woman, because they're both caught in this patriarchal, very oppressive society. What I loved about this was the vivid sense of place. I got a real sense of Kashmir ringed by mountains, the political conflicts it's immersed in, being administered by different countries. And also this idea of that the town that she's in is filled with, not filled, but there are other women who are what they call half widows, women whose husbands have been taken away, disappeared, and they're in this sort of netherworld of, they're not full widows, they can't really move on with their lives, but Islamic law says that after a certain amount of years you can, so she needs a death certificate. And so it becomes this frustrating experience with this extremely corrupt bureaucracy. And you see this woman slowly finding her inner strength and defending her rights in a situation that feels very hopeless. It's a fantastically performance by Shilpi Marva. And she's a theater actress as well as a film actress, and you get that. And the film, by the way, is in Urdu with subtitles. But what I love about it is that it captures the rhythms of daily life. The pace is incredibly deliberate. It is ruminative. The atmosphere is very immersive. And in some ways it feels serene, but, it sort of masks this turmoil that's going on. you know, everywhere, where people are being disappeared, where, you know, terrorism is happening, people are just being killed. But at the same time, there's this beautiful cinematography that in some ways did feel to me like ethnography a little bit. And there's a lot of, oftentimes there's no dialogue, it's just ambient sounds like sweeping or water running. I was really immersed and caught up, and I thought it was beautifully done.
Widow of Silence, the film from India, written and directed by Praveen Morchelli, starring Shrilpi Marva. The film is unrated, and you can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The Old Guard, an action-adventure movie that stars Charlize Theron, Kiki Layne, directed by Gina Prince-Bythewood, and written by Greg Rucka. Wait, what'd you think of The Old Guard?
Oh, so much good and so much bad at the same time. Gina Prince-Bythewood is an enormously talented director. She was a graduate student at UCLA when I was an undergrad and already one of the budding stars there along with Alexander Payne. And if you saw Love and Basketball, you know what she can do when she has a great script and she's at the peak of her powers. She's a little bit hamstrung here by a genre piece that Netflix apparently wants to turn into a franchise. And I think the problem is that the story of immortals is such an enormous concept, and we've seen it done very well in the original Highlander, where the myth sort of dominates the style and dictates the style. And the problem here is that they have a very, very pedestrian story wrapped around this enormous mythical concept. And when you have people who are, you know, almost like a team of Avengers and superheroes who cannot die and they've lived for hundreds and thousands of years, and they're going toe-to-toe with a narcissistic young pharmaceutical executive, there's an imbalance of power in that. And it sort of minimizes the stature of who these people are and what they do. They're going to war with a pharmaceutical guy. After thousands of years, it comes down to a guy who wants to do some genetic analysis on them. It comments on the here and now, but it doesn't rise to the level of what this theme begs for, what audiences want to see from it. And again, I refer people to Highlander, which sort of elevated itself to the mythical stature of this enormous premise. That said, within the confines of being a fairly pedestrian story, it's really well done. I mean, it's beautifully directed and staged. Charlize Theron just gives it her all, really nails it. You know, Chiwetel Ejiofor gets a kind of thankless supporting part and turns it into something much more than it has any business being. Everyone is really, really doing their best work here. It's just that the material doesn't give them room to go as far as they should.
The film's The Old Guard, action-adventure movie. Gina Prince-Bythewood is the director. The movie's rated R, and you can see it streaming on Netflix. The documentary Runner follows marathoner Gore McCare on his journey from refugee to becoming South Sudan's first Olympian. Bill Gallagher, the director of Runner. Claudia.
I love this film. It's so powerful and it's so moving and it's inspirational. Gore McCare is this incredibly charismatic and determined person. I'm sure you remember the documentary that came out, I think early 2000s, maybe 2003, called Lost Boys of the Sudan. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And this is kind of, you know, kind of takes off from there. He was one of the lost boys. He was in South Sudan. He kind of was separated from his family at about 7 years old. And then he faced war and famine and enslavement. And he was on the run literally for most of his childhood. And then he ended up meeting back up with his aunt and uncle in a refugee camp. And then he and the family were sponsored by a church in Concord, New Hampshire. So he ends up in Concord, New Hampshire, which couldn't be more different from Sudan. And he takes up track in high school and he becomes a track star. And then he goes on to college in Iowa, where he further excels in track. And he goes on to run in the Olympics in London. And what I love, I have to say, inspirational sports stories are not among my favorite genres. I try not to ever have a favorite genre, but sometimes they just hit certain beats, and this is not that film. You know, he doesn't go to the Olympics and come in first or third or even fifth. He comes in like 87th, but the point is not his ranking. The point is what he means and signifies to his people. And at the time when he's running, South Sudan had just become its own separate country, but there, because of some bureaucratic sort of snafus. There was no Olympic committee. He couldn't really run for South Sudan, so he ran as a man without a country. That got some coverage at the time. But what it meant to the people in London who were emigres from South Sudan is, you know, undefinable. It's just, it meant so much, and they cheer him on, and that's so inspiring. And then he goes back and sees his parents, and it's one of the most emotional, heart-wrenching scenes you'll ever see. He's so passionate about helping his people and his family. And this is the first documentary by Bill Gallagher. I think he does a beautiful job. And they also intersperse some really lovely animated sequences, because obviously they didn't have footage from his childhood when he was, you know, barely surviving in Sudan. So they create these animated sequences to illustrate it. And it's just really beautifully done. I love this film.
Talking about the documentary Runner, following the story of Gore McCair. Peter.
Yeah, I don't like it quite as much as Claudia, but it's certainly, you know, worthwhile and inspirational, and it's a great subject for a film. It's a bit scattershot, I think, as a piece of documentary filmmaking. I wasn't nuts about the animated flashbacks. And on some level, Gore is as clear and present as he is in this movie, remains something of a cipher, at least to me. And maybe that's just the nature of the documentary itself. And if this had been a dramatized film with an actor, you know, maybe in some ways it would have gotten into more of the psychology of it. But it's a powerful movie. And the reunion scene with his parents after a 20-year separation is I defy you to watch that with a dry eye. So it's a remarkable testament to a remarkable person.
Runner, the documentary's unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Relic, we'll just start with this very, very briefly, because then we need to break. Horror film from Australia, Emily Mortimer, starring Natalie Erica James, the director and co-screenwriter. Wade, can you give us just a quick synopsis, and we'll do more when we come back?
Yeah, this is directed by Natalie Erica James, feature director, kind of following on Jennifer Kent in this new Australian feminist horror genre, all about in which Emily Mortimer and Bella Heathcote are a mother and daughter who go to visit Emily Mortimer's mother, who is suffering from dementia, and things are not well in the house. It's ghosts and haunted house and all kinds of spooky stuff.
All right, we'll find out more about it and whether it's truly spooky. Relic is the film. But again, we take you into our break on Film Week with another one of the classic scores from Ennio Morricone, who died Monday of this week at the age of 89. This from the second film in the Dollars trilogy, For a Few Dollars More. It's Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. You're listening to a piece of the beautiful score that Ennio Morricone wrote for The Mission. The oboe, such a primary part of the score for that film. All throughout today's program, we're playing some excerpts from some of the wonderful scores that he did with so many directors over the course of decades. Morricone died at the age of 91 earlier this week. I gave his age improperly last time. He's 91 years of age and passed. We continue on Film Week with the horror movie Relic. We just heard Wade briefly set it up. A feminist horror film starring Emily Mortimer, Robin Nevin, and Bella Heathcote. Natalie Erica James is the director and co-screenwriter. Wade, how successful was it in giving you the chills?
You know, it like so many of these films, it starts well, and then they paint themselves into a corner and don't really know how to sort of resolve the mystery. clearly in this old family house on this old rural family property somewhere in Australia, the grandmother, Robin Nevin, is experiencing something creepy and weird that has to do apparently with the fact that one of the windows in the house was taken from an old cabin that used to sit on the property many years earlier, and that's never really explored or explained. All you know is that because of that window and somebody's ghost apparently lingering, things get black and walls move and the house is just otherwise weird and creepy and freaky. And then the movie gets to a point where they kind of throw in the towel and just say, we can't explain any of this, so we're just going to go for broke and be as weird as possible. And it ends on a completely inexplicable note. It's a real head scratcher, but it's creepy until you get there. So I guess it's a mixed bag overall.
All right. What'd you think, Claudia? Relic.
Yeah, I generally agree. I might have liked it a jot more. There was a screening last night at a drive-in, and I'm guessing that it's also playing at drive-ins.
It is.
Good, because I think it's actually a really good movie for a drive-in. I unfortunately didn't see it there, so I almost feel like I want to go back and see it there. I'm always happy to see Emily Mortimer in a film. I think she's such a good actress, and we see her too rarely, it seems. And I like the sort of twist on the haunted house movie. I like how it explores the mother-daughter relationships, and I particularly like it sort of as a parable about dementia or an allegory about the devastation of it. The cinematography is quite elegant. The performances are good. I do agree that it kind of falls apart a little bit in the final act, but there is this really creepy, eerie stylishness about it. And it has this sort of mounting sense of dread that I appreciate. So overall, I think it's, you know, it's fairly good. It's not as good as I would have hoped.
Relic, a horror film from Australia. It's rated R. You can see it at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair, the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside. It's also available on just about every video on-demand platform anyone has ever invented. It's widely available. Relic is rated R. Next film is a German-Austrian co-production, The Tobacconist, starring Bruno Ganz. This is a posthumous release. Nicholas Leitner, the director and co-screenwriter of The Tobacconist. Peter?
Well, this is a good subject matter for a movie. The movie being something else than that, for the most part. 17-year-old Franz journeys to Vienna, where he works in a tobacco shop. The tobacco shop is run by a one-legged World War One vet, well played by Johannes Krisch, whose clients include Jews and communists, which doesn't sit well with the surrounding proprietors. One of the clients that he has, a regular for the cigars, is Sigmund Freud. And Franz takes up a friendship with Freud. He has a girlfriend or a would-be girlfriend that he wants information about. And Freud says he doesn't understand women any better than the kid does. And, you know, he comes up with all sorts of bon mots, like you don't have to understand water to just jump into the water, which I guess is a variation on sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. In any event, the relationship between Franz and Freud is somewhat interesting, but not really fleshed out terribly. Bruno Ganz is always marvelous to watch, and it's sad that this was, I believe, his last film. He's not in the movie from front to back, but when he is, he certainly commands the screen. There are a number of surreal dream scenes that are worked into this very conventional piece of filmmaking that don't really work because they seem so jarring with the rest of the movie. Plus, they don't seem to emanate from Franz's imagination anyway. Just as a quick side note, I was thinking, what were some of the really great dream scenes in movies? And I think the two best was the mother meat sequence in Los Olvidados by Buñuel and the opening sequence from 8 and a Half, which is the greatest dream sequence in film history.
The Tobacconist movie we're talking about, Wade?
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way. I mean, it's sort of like Scent of a Woman with Sigmund Freud and Nazis, but it basically is that. It feels a little bit pedestrian to have a movie involving Sigmund Freud where the most that he does is sort of help a kid with his girl problems. But that said, it does give you an interesting representation of the Anschluss when Nazi Germany absorbed Austria by democratic vote, which previously most people only know through The Sound of Music. So here you get a slightly more grounded version of what that meant and how it impacted Austrian society. And to that extent, I think the film and certainly Bruno Ganz do us a great favor.
The Tobacconist, Claudia.
Well, I will echo the concern, the, you know, sense that it's conventional and pedestrian. I feel like, you know, here is a film that took place in one of the most traumatic periods of history, and it's surprisingly dull and bland. It feels kind of more like it's pretty. It's a chance to play dress up in this sort of, you know, historical era. It's got attractive cinematography and production design and costume design, but it doesn't really have much heft. Politically, philosophically, historically, you know, having it kind of uses Freud as window dressing. It didn't work for me.
The Tobacconist is unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The Australian comedic drama Never Too Late stars James Cromwell, Dennis Waterman, and Jackie Weaver. Mark Lemprell is the director, and Luke Preston wrote it. Peter.
This is being promoted as a sort of cross between the Grumpy Old Men and The Great Escape. I would say there's quite a bit more of the grumpy old men in this movie than The Great Escape. It's about four former POWs during Vietnam who broke out of prison, and now they find themselves, there's an Australian retirement home where they're for returned vets, and so they're all there, but they want to break out of that too because it's you know, not where they want to be. James Cromwell is one of the four vets. He breaks into it, actually, because he wants to meet up with a nurse there that he loved and lost 40 years before, played by Jackie Weaver. But she leaves shortly after their reunion to go to a retirement home for dementia patients. So it's all, you know, kind of breaking in and out of things. The cast is enjoyable. Besides Cromwell, it includes Roy Billing and Shane Jacobson, Dennis Waterman, but you know, it's very conventional. It's very standard. It's very sentimental. You can see where it's going. It's kind of fun and benign anyway to see the way they work this out. They all want to realize their unrealized dreams. One wants to sail off into the distance. James Cromwell wants to marry Jackie Weaver, and so forth. One funny side note is that James Cromwell is a good 6'7". I've met both him and Jackie Weaver in person. He's a good 6'7". She's 5 feet and change. So when they are together, you really have to hand it to the director and the cinematographer to kind of make it look as if, you know, she's not looking up at the Matterhorn every time she gazes into his eyes.
Challenging angles. Never Too Late, Australian comedic drama, is the film. Mark Lemprell, the director, Luke Preston, the screenwriter. It's unrated and available, as so many of this week's films are, on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. We're joined this week by critics Peter Rayner, Wade Major, and Claudia Puig, another of the great scores of Ennio Morricone, this from Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to Relate podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC in the KPCC app. Ennio Morricone's score from A Fistful of Dollars, his first collaboration on the Dollars trilogy, Clint Eastwood starring in those films. I'm joined by Film Week critics Claudia Puig, Wade Major, and Peter Rayner. Next up is the, I guess you call it staged documentary, Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, from the filmmaking brothers Bill and Turner Ross. Claudia?
Yeah, I'm a purist about documentaries, I guess. I mean, I like, you know, sort of genre blending, but I really question the ethics of calling this a documentary. It's supposed to take place on the final night of a bar that's in Las Vegas. It's in fact in New Orleans. It doesn't exist. I don't understand why you wouldn't actually film what goes on in a real dive bar or several dive bars. But this, it's only fitfully interesting. It's, you know, if you like the idea of, you know, listening to drunken losers opine belligerently and threaten to fight and sing and dance and fall asleep, then have at it. But otherwise, I think it doesn't really work as a documentary at all.
Apparently, there really is a bar, I don't think this based on it, called the Roaring Twenties in the New Orleans area, but this is supposed to be set in Vegas, as you said. Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets is unrated. It's available on Alamo on demand. Enter The Fat Dragon, a Chinese action comedy from Kenji Tanigaki. Wade?
This is kind of a reboot of the 1978 film of the same name, which starred Sammo Hung, who came from the same childhood Peking opera class as Jackie Chan, and who was in the original Enter the Dragon as a very young man. And Sammo, of course, has traded on his corpulence his entire career. Here, they are paying homage both to the original Enter the Dragon and to the original Sammo Hung film. Donnie Yen puts on a fat suit and has more fun than I've ever seen him have in a movie. This is a credit to writer Wong Jing, who is one of the most insane people in the history of Hong Kong cinema, and who also appears in the film, and it's a whole lot of fun. The action is great. The comedy is terrific. It's sentimental. It's wacky. It's just an absolute blast. It's a throwback to the Hong Kong New Wave, and I'm grateful for that.
Enter the Fat Dragon is unrated on Google Play and iTunes On Demand starting early next week. Family Romance LLC, written and directed by Werner Herzog. Peter?
This is an intriguingly oddball movie from Werner Herzog, nothing new. It's based on a real situation in Japan. There's a flourishing industry of people who are rent themselves out to substitute for real people in awkward situations, etc. There's for instance, if you're a bride walking down the aisle, but your father's an alcoholic, you can rent somebody to be your father for the day. That's actually part of this film. Yuichi Ishii is the real-life head of a company called A Family Romance, which does this sort of thing, and he plays himself in this film. In the film, he's playing someone who's playing characters that he's assigned and paid to play, such as the father of a 12-year-old girl who never knew her father, and so forth. So it's a really convoluted Meebus strip kind of scenario. It seems documentary-like in many ways, although it's not, except that some of the actors are playing themselves, like Ishii. So overall, I think it's certainly anomaly even by Herzog standards, but it's so intriguing, the whole premise, that I think it carries you through the film.
Family Romance LLC from Werner Herzog is unrated, and it's on the Mubi streaming service, Video on Demand. And finally, the LA set comedy Devos from director Ryan Patrick Bartley. Wade?
This is one of those little LA indie films. It riffs on a high school musical that features two rival actors. One of them is kind of a converted jock. The other one is a lifelong thespian, and their rivalry. And you think it's going to probably take some fairly predictable turns until it throws a gear halfway through and becomes a completely unexpected kind of film that's much smarter and much wiser than I think people might be expecting. So I found it to be a really refreshing script and really in this genre of indies, quite an outlier.
It's written by Matt Steele, who also stars in Devos. Claudia?
Yeah, I agree. It was fun. It was slight, but you know, the making of a high school musical is a fun idea. It's well written. It's well acted too. There's this main trio of friends, Matt Steele, Luis Avila, and Julia Boyd, who are quite good. And there's some great little lines. There was one about every time you're on stage, everyone falls in love with you, which is weird because normally everybody hates you. And, you know, you kind of can imagine kids saying something just like that. So, yeah, it worked.
Devos is Unrated. It's on iTunes and Amazon Prime Video starting Tuesday of next week. We want to take this moment to remember Ennio Morricone, the wonderful film composer who died Monday at the age of 91. We know him, of course, for his collaborations with filmmaker Sergio Leone, but he worked with so many directors, including Quentin Tarantino on The Hateful Eight, for which he won an Oscar. And, of course, the soundtrack for Cinema Paradiso as well. Let's start with you, Wade. Your thoughts about Morricone and his legacy.
It's incomparable. I mean, there is simply no other composer, not even John Williams, not any of the Newmans. There is no other composer in film history who left this kind of vast, vast, far-reaching legacy in so many different countries and so many different kinds of films. It's incomparable. And he was an artist in the sense that even though every one of his scores was so different, it still had that Ennio Morricone sound. You still knew, you felt his heart and his soul in every single one of those scores. I mean, things for like Days of Heaven, you know, are oftentimes not remembered because the others are just so great.
Yeah.
Milena, you know, he did so many lesser scores that are lesser only because they're not as good as his best, but they're still among the best scores ever written.
Claudia.
Yeah, is there anything more iconic in all of film than those first notes of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? I think they call it a coyote call or something. I mean, I just feel like that is the most iconic riff of any film ever. And he was just a great composer, not just for soundtracks, but he was a fantastic composer in general.
I mean, including
his music is so indelible.
Including avant-garde music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter, quick, your thoughts on Morricone.
Yeah, one of the greats. You know, his incredibly versatile, and you know, he worked intimately with some of the major Italian directors of the era, such as Bellocchio and Bertolucci as well. The scores for 1900, Partecorvo, the Battle of Algiers score is incredible. The score for Burn with Marlon Brando is one of his best. His music never overtook the movie in the sense that, you know, you were just listening to the music without watching the movie, unless it was a really terrible movie. But there was a real synergy between his music and the imagery at his best that really just heightened these films tremendously.
All right. And we should quickly mention Earl Cameron, who died at the age of 102, pioneering British actor. Real quickly, your memories of him, Peter.
He was one of the first black actors to really break through in the UK. He did a lot of movies that are not well seen here, Pool of London, Sapphire, Flame in the Streets. He was a marvelous actor. I met him at the Bermuda Film Festival some years ago when he was a mere 90, did a Q&A, and he was a tremendously graceful and terrific person, as well as just a great actor and a pathfinder.
All right, Peter Rayner, Wade Major, Claudia Puig joining us on Film Week this week as we remember Earl Cameron, who died at the age of 102. He died a week ago. And we remember Ennio Morricone, the great composer, as we listen to his theme for Cinema Paradiso. Thank you so much for joining us on Film Week here on KPCC.